Since the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, we've heard the phrase herd immunity a lot. It's often touted as a way to end the spread of the virus. The theory is that herd immunity happens when enough people become protected against a virus, either through vaccines or infection. Scientists initially estimate that about 70% of the population would need immunity for this to work. But in recent weeks, more than a dozen scientists told the New York Times that the threshold to herd immunity could actually be much lower, around 45 to 50% of the population in some communities. So while there's still uncertainty about how herd immunity works in the COVID-19 context, it could be a bit closer than researchers initially expected. For more on this, I'm joined by Apoorva Mandavilli, science reporter at the New York Times, and Jeffrey Shaiman, professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Apoorva, let's start with you. What do we mean when we talk about herd immunity in the context of COVID-19?
Well, as you mentioned, herd immunity is the concept that enough people are protected from a pathogen, in this case, the coronavirus, that they have some level of immunity, either by having had the infection once or by having gotten a vaccine. And the idea is that when you get to that level, the virus starts to run out of people to infect and slows down in circulation. And so we get to a point where we see fewer and fewer outbreaks. Not none, but fewer and slower.
Jeff, are there different types of herd immunity? I mean, can you explain the difference between the natural, i.e. getting the virus and then having antibodies, and the vaccine-related version of this?
Sure, they're a bit related. So in the natural course of an outbreak, people are being infected and there's transmission from person to person. Provided that the people who have been infected, once they've recovered from it, develop antibodies that confer some kind of protection, and they have other components of the memory system as well, the memory immune system. But if that confers protection, those people, at least for a time, are going to be out of circulation when it comes to being infected with the virus again or transmitting it. They're removed from the whole transmission cycle. So what you have is sort of a winnowing of the population that can be infected down in numbers. And as that happens, you run out of people to infect. And so that's the natural process that occurs over the course of the outbreak that results in it first rising as you're burning through people and they're becoming infected, and then it declines over time because you've run out of people to infect. A vaccination short circuits this. It just does the process artificially. It comes in, and by providing some people antigenic material in the form of an inoculant, it induces an antibody response, and those antibodies then provide you the preemptive power to clear the virus from your system without really becoming infectious yourself.
I'm curious, Jeff, there's lots of talk about getting antibody tests for COVID-19, and there's still a lot of questions out about whether or not someone is immune to COVID-19 once they've had the virus. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I would say the big question, or one of the big questions concerning this virus, is, are people one and done with it? When they're infected, are they conferred with lifelong immunity against it? Do they have a robust antibody response? Are those going to last? Or do they wane over time, or through the processes that have to do with the mutation of the virus over the time, is the virus able to escape those memory immune components and infect somebody again? So the question is, can you be reinfected? And if so, at what time scale? Is it every year? Is it every 5 years? Is it every 20 years? Those are really important questions for understanding what the circulation of this virus will be going forward.
Apoorva, you know, there are folks who say we can just achieve herd immunity if we just live our lives and don't wear our masks. And, you know, people who get infected will get infected and we'll just kind of get to this naturally. And this is without a vaccine available. Is there a danger in relying on that theory without a vaccine available? Or basically, are more people going to die?
I mean, the danger is deaths, as you've just said. You know, we've already had 177,000 in the United States, and that's with most of the population still not having been exposed to the virus and not having gotten sick. So if we just allowed the virus to run rampant, the cost in human lives and in the cost in long-term effects for people who recover would just be staggering.
How has our understanding of herd immunity shifted from the early days in the pandemic?
So in the early days, epidemiologists were estimating that we would need to have, you know, 60 to 70% of the population be infected with the coronavirus or have gotten a vaccine and be protected, you know, for herd immunity. And that was based on the kinds of calculations that they usually do to figure out what percent of the population needs to be vaccinated. But what we are now thinking, or scientists are now saying, is that when you take into account the fact that people in the population don't all socialize in the same way, don't all have the same vulnerability to the virus. Some people are more vulnerable, for example, older people. Some people socialize more, for example, teenagers and people in their 20s. And when you take all of that kind of variability into account in a mathematical model, the percent that you need to have protection in the population drops from 60 to 70 to something more like 45 to 50%. So it's a little bit lower than we thought, which is overall good news.
Jeff, I want to ask you about Sweden, and I just want to have a disclaimer here that I don't think we can compare the United States to Sweden, but I'm curious about the headlines about Sweden, where some of the country's top epidemiologists have said that schools should reopen so that children can essentially achieve herd immunity. What do we make of that? And again, with the disclaimer that the United States is 300 million some odd residents compared to Sweden's much smaller population.
Yeah, you know, Sweden only has a population of 10 million, but they're conducting a unique social and epidemiological experiment. Very early on, the Swedish government, in consultation with some epidemiologists, decided that in some sense they were going to go for herd immunity, that they weren't going to disrupt their economy the way some of the other countries in Europe were attempting, and that they were going to let the virus run its course. And what we saw with them, particularly if you were to compare it to neighboring Scandinavian countries like Norway and Denmark, is Sweden has undergone much higher rates of infection and many more deaths. However, they haven't gotten to the point of herd immunity yet, because even though that was the case, they were still doing some things. The government was encouraging people to be careful, but there wasn't a lot of mask usage from the reports that I'd seen, and people were still going to restaurants. But they ultimately did close schools, as I understand, and they have protected nursing homes and long-term care facilities, and the elderly have been sort of shut off. Sort of some of that variability in contacts that Apoorva was talking about is still present within Swedish society. If they're sticking with it still, and they haven't had a huge accumulation of cases recently in the last month, and they're thinking about opening schools, they're pushing the experiment a bit further, because schools are mixing environments. They're little mass gatherings that happen on a daily basis with students, teachers, and staff, and they provide additional opportunities for the virus to pass from person to person. Now, obviously, you can take additional steps to try to control this. You can socially distance, you can thin out the class size, you could encourage mask wearing, et cetera. But given Sweden's policy, it doesn't sound like they would be doing too much of this. And instead, they were hoping that the virus moves through the student population. And children aren't typically that adversely affected by this virus, though their teachers can be, and let them build up this herd immunity that they've been going for, infect more people, and get them out of circulation so that they can't then pass it on to others once they've recovered.
Question, Jeff, because I am not an epidemiologist. I'm a journalist asking questions that I think a lot of people have here. And I'm wondering, is the theory of herd immunity even realistic? I mean, we have a flu shot every year for the we have not achieved a certain amount of herd immunity with the basic common cold. You know, when we're children, we have to get vaccines for measles and mumps and many other things. And I think lately we've been seeing folks who are challenging the idea of vaccines altogether. Is herd immunity actually achievable in this context, or is it a way for people to challenge the idea of vaccines?
I think you're getting a bit of both. I certainly think people who are opposed to vaccines, anti-vaxxers, even the vaccine hesitant, are going to be looking at this and wondering about safety associated with a vaccine that's rolled out so quickly. However, vaccines are very effective. They have supported our modern society and our lifestyles in the Western world that we have really grown accustomed to. The examples of the common cold and influenza and the fact that we haven't really been able to curb them, particularly flu with the vaccine, has to do with the same processes I talked about in relationship to COVID-19, simply that this virus, the flu, mutates all the time, and the vaccine isn't particularly effective, unfortunately. And as a result of these two things, people get the virus over and over and over again with a vaccine that's not fully effective. Now, science has been trying to catch up and get that under control so we could have what's called a universal vaccine that's much more effective so people don't have to get the flu, but we're not there yet. But if you were to look at other diseases, things like polio and smallpox, the vaccines we've developed there are highly effective and they result in lifelong immunity so that people never have to experience those infections. Those are very, very powerful medical tools, and they've been remarkable in their ability to allow us to their ability to control these viruses, and in one case, even eradicate the disease.
Apoorva, is there any reason to be optimistic based on your reporting here? I mean, is there a chance, and I know this is what so many Americans and people around the world want, that this virus might actually, this pandemic might actually end?
I think there is cause for optimism. There are all of these vaccines in development, and vaccines can actually be more effective in inducing herd immunity than natural infection because we can strengthen the vaccines in ways that we can't tweak the human body. And so, you know, for example, today there were reports this morning that there is a case of reinfection out of Hong Kong. And if that's true, people might say that that means that vaccines won't be effective. But in fact, the opposite is true. If, you know, we are prone to being reinfected with this virus, say after just a few months, it'll be even more important to have a vaccine that can give us a little bit longer lasting immunity. You know, there are things that we can add to vaccines to make sure that they're stronger than an infection would be in getting us to produce a very strong and robust immune response that lasts a certain amount of time. It may be that we need to be vaccinated every year, like we do with the flu vaccine, but at least we'll have those answers in the next few months.
Apoorva Mandavilli is a science reporter at the New York Times, and Jeffrey Shaman is a professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.